listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson on Thursday spoke at his alma mater, the University of Texas at Austin, about U.S. engagement in the Western Hemisphere. Tillerson won a Bachelor of Science degree in Civil Engineering in 1975 from UT Austin and began his employment with Exxon Company USA later that year. We bring you his remarks in their entirety.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And thank you, Greg, for that very, very kind, warm introduction, inviting me back home today. And I want to thank those at the Clement Center of National Security and the Robert Strauss Center for International Security and Law for hosting the event as well. As Greg mentioned to you, today does mark my one-year anniversary as Secretary of State. A year ago this time, I had entered the State Department, stood on the steps in the foyer, and had my first chance to have a conversation with my newest colleagues and friends in the State Department about things that are important to me and values that I wanted to bring to the State Department. And it's been a very busy whirlwind year, but it's really nice to celebrate it among friends back home as well. So I'm just delighted to be here. Of course, it's always a special honor and pleasure to get to speak at your alma mater, and in particular at an institution that houses the Presidential Library of one of our most storied Texans to serve in Washington. LBJ bemoaned, as some of you may know, what he considered an East Coast elitist approach to foreign policy. He once said, I don't believe I'll ever get credit for anything I do in foreign affairs, no matter how successful it is, because I didn't go to Harvard. I didn't either. And worse, I'm an engineer. But I got one up on LBJ. He didn't go to the University of Texas. I have said before that this university shaped me in so many ways, both personal and professional. an interesting story. When I was a freshman in the Longhorn Band, a group of about 100 members of the band flew down to Peru for a special mission trip. There had been a major earthquake in Peru and an enormous refugee problem coming out of the mountains into the area of Lima, and a group of Texans went down to help raise money and bring awareness to the situation. It was an extraordinary trip. Interestingly, first passport I got. Went to the passport office, got my first passport. First foreign country I ever visited was with the University of Texas Longhorn Band of Peru. And it was interesting. It was a very successful trip. The band was a huge hit down in Lima. And the U.S. ambassador to Peru even expressed he had some concerns that the Eyes of Texas was going to replace the Star-Spangled Banner as the official anthem at the events. Regrettably, we left for that trip after a loss at the Cotton Bowl, but the show band of the Southwest won in Peru, I assure you. So as I look to the coming weeks, when I will return to Peru on my first multi-stop visit to Latin America's Secretary of State, it does feel a bit like coming full circle. And I'm proud today, UT Austin's Teresa Lozano Long Institute of Latin American Studies, its Mexico Center, and its host of international programs do contribute to educate students about this very important region of the world. This trip comes at an important time for the Western Hemisphere. This diverse region, which includes Canada, Mexico, South America, and the Caribbean, is a priority for the United States for reasons other than simply our geographic proximity. We share an interwoven history and chronology. Our nations still reflect the New World optimism of limitless discovery. And importantly, we share democratic values, values that are at the core of what we believe, regardless of the color of our passport. And for generations, U.S. leaders have understood that building relationships with Latin American and Caribbean partners is integral to the success and prosperity of our region. In 1889, at the urging of then Secretary of State James Blaine, the United States hosted the first International Conference of American States, the precursor to today's OAS, or Organization of American States. At the beginning of the 20th century, President Teddy Roosevelt visited Panama, the first foreign visit of a U.S. sitting president in our history. And during the 1960s, President Kennedy established the Alliance for Progress, his ambitious plan to strengthen economic cooperation among the United States and the hemisphere, and to, in his words, eliminate tyranny from a hemisphere in which it has no rightful place. Today, we share these same goals as the visionary leaders before us, to eliminate tyranny and to further the cause of economic and political freedom throughout our hemisphere. As 2018 begins, we have an historic opportunity to do just that. A few weeks ago, the United States co-hosted a ministerial with our counterparts in Canada and Vancouver. 20 countries joined us to discuss the global threat posed by North Korea. In April, Peru will host the Summit of the Americas to highlight our region's commitment to fighting corruption. 2 months later, Canada will host the 44th G7 Summit. And at the end of this year, the G20 states will convene in Buenos Aires, the first South American city ever to host. So in many ways, 2018 marks the year of the Americas. Many of the world's leaders will be in this hemisphere, and as such, the eyes of the world will turn to the Americas. So today I want to focus on three pillars of engagement to further the cause of freedom throughout our region in 2018 and beyond: economic growth, security, and democratic governance. The hemisphere has significant potential for greater economic growth and prosperity. We will build upon the solid foundation of economic cooperation with our Latin American and Caribbean partners. Brazil, for instance, is the region's largest economy and the ninth largest in the world. The United States is Brazil's second largest trading partner, with two-way trade at record highs in recent years, totaling more than $95 billion in 2015. The United States has free trade agreements with 20 countries. 12 of those countries are in the Western Hemisphere. And every year, the United States trades almost $2 trillion worth of goods and services with Latin America and Caribbean nations, supporting more than 2.5 million jobs here at home. Instead of a trade deficit, we actually have a $14 billion trade surplus with the hemisphere. But today we have an opportunity to further our economic partnership and the prosperity of the peoples in this hemisphere. An important step to strengthen North American economic prosperity and integration is to modernize the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. I'm a Texan, former energy executive, and I'm also a rancher. I understand how important NAFTA is for our economy and that of the continent. But it should come as no surprise that an agreement put into place 30 years ago, before the advent of the digital age and the digital economy, before China's rise as the world's second largest economy, that NAFTA would need to be modernized. Our aim is simple: to strengthen our economy and that of all of North America, to remain the most competitive, economically vibrant region in the world. We appreciate the hard work of our Mexican and Canadian counterparts throughout these negotiations. Last week, we concluded round six, and we will continue to work toward a modernized agreement with another round scheduled next month. Building greater prosperity by integrating the wealth of energy resources within the hemisphere is an opportunity that is unique in the world to the Americas. Over the past decade, North America has been leading an energy renaissance. By 2040, North America is expected to add more oil production to the global markets than the entire rest of the world combined, and more gas production than any other single region. The flow of crude oil, natural gas, refined products, and electricity already crosses our borders in both directions, leading to greater reliability, more efficiency, and lower costs to consumers. Our continent has become the energy force for this century, thanks in large part to rapid expansion in natural gas and tight oil production, and of course thanks to some great engineers, many produced right here at UT. The rest of the hemisphere can use the North American experience as a model. We see a future where energy connectivity from Canada to Chile can build out and seize upon energy integration throughout the Americas, delivering greater energy security to the hemisphere and stability to growing economies. South America is blessed with abundant energy resources. Colombia, Peru, Brazil, Guyana, and Argentina all have significant undeveloped oil and natural gas. The United States is eager to help our partners develop their own resources safely, responsibly, as energy demand continues to grow. Excuse me. Our hemispheric energy trade is already beginning to meet these needs. 36% of U.S. liquefied natural gas exports since 2016 have landed in Latin America. That's more than any other region in the world. Between now and 2030, Latin America is expected to spend at least $70 billion on new electric power generation plants to fuel economic growth. Many of those plants will be powered by natural gas. The United States should be a substantive and reliable supplier. By building out a more flexible and robust energy system in our hemisphere, we can power our economies with affordable energy. We can lift more people out of poverty, and we can make our hemisphere the undisputed seat of global energy supply. To support and capture this opportunity requires the opening of more market economies. The opening of energy markets in Mexico, for example, has led to greater private investment, more competition, and more energy trade with the United States than ever before. Truly a win-win. Further south, we are partnering with Central America to strengthen its regional electricity market and modernize its grid. Creating stronger Central American economies by lowering energy costs is critical to building a more secure Central America. We have the chance to develop an energy partnership that spans the Western Hemisphere to the benefit of all of our citizens. We cannot afford to squander this moment. A transition to more market-based economic reforms are not limited to the energy sector. Argentina, under President Macri's leadership, has made monumental strides in delivering reforms to open the Argentine economy and pursue growth for all Argentinians. Its historically high inflation rate is finally decreasing. GDP is going up, spurred on by investment and soaring consumer confidence. And 1 week after the U.S. Congress passed landmark tax reform policy, Argentina's legislature took action to overhaul their tax system as well. All of these efforts are making the second largest economy in South America ripe for more investment and growth. We hope more countries take a similar path to help the entire hemisphere grow in prosperity. But for prosperity to take root, we must create the conditions for regional stability. Economic development and security reinforce each other. When individuals are living in poverty, a life of crime can look like the only opportunity available to make a living. Legal and illegal immigration increases as people look for more opportunity elsewhere. And innocent people are more likely to become victims of drug cartels, human traffickers, and corrupt law enforcement authorities. The United States approach is holistic. We must address security and development issues side by side. You cannot expect to have one without the other. The most immediate threat to our hemisphere are transnational criminal organizations, or TCOs. In their pursuit of money and power, TCOs leave death and destruction in their wake. As humans, weapons, opioids, and other drugs are smuggled, law enforcement and civilians become the targets. Here at home, Americans do not necessarily see the day-to-day violence that is so common in other parts of our hemisphere. But U.S. demand for drugs drives this violence and this lawlessness. We acknowledge our role as the major market for illicit drug consumption and the need for shared approaches to address these challenges. The opioid epidemic we are facing in this country is a clear, tragic representation of how interconnected our hemisphere truly is. Violence and drugs do not stop at our southern border. That is why we continue to employ a coordinated multilateral approach to diminish the influence of these groups. It is time we rid our hemisphere of the violence and devastation that they promote. I co-chair a high-level dialogue with Foreign Secretary Videgaray of Mexico to discuss new and strategic ways to disrupt TCOs. We must take new approaches to disrupt their business models, models of cartels which operate much like any other business organization that maximizes their value chain from feedstock to manufacturing to distribution to marketing and sales. The second meeting of our dialogue was held in Washington this past December, which included Secretary Nielsen of the Department of Homeland Security and Attorney General Jeff Sessions, as well as our Mexican counterparts. We also had with us law enforcement representatives from both countries. Dismantling TCOs is not just a diplomatic issue. Obviously, it requires integrating the skills and expertise of law enforcement to interdict shipments of illegal drugs, attack the revenue streams and the weapons feeding TCOs, and to track down and prosecute the middlemen who enable them. Close collaboration among multiple agencies within our own government and with our international partners is essential. The way we combat threats to our southern border security is to work collaboratively with Mexico to strengthen Mexico's southern border. Through the Merida Initiative, a partnership between the United States and Mexico focused on improving security and the rule of law, the United States is providing assistance to build the capacity of Mexican law enforcement and judicial institutions. By providing inspection equipment, canine units, and training, we equip law enforcement officers with tools to eradicate opium poppy production, tighten border security, and disrupt trafficking activities not just in drugs, but in trafficking of humans. By improving cross-border communications, we make both sides of the border safer. And our security partnerships extend beyond just our southern border or Mexico's southern border. Colombia has been one of our strongest partners in the region. Following decades of long internal battle with revolutionary forces of the FARC, Colombia has charted a pathway to peace. We continue to support this sustainable peace, but challenges do remain. Colombia is the world's largest producer of cocaine, the source of 92% of the cocaine seized in the United States. Last year, and with U.S. support, Colombian police and military forces eradicated 130,000 acres of coca fields, the highest number since 2010. The same year, Colombian forces seized nearly 500 metric tons of cocaine. There's more work ahead. Regrettably, coca cultivation has skyrocketed in recent years. In 2016, more than 460,000 acres in Colombia were used for coca cultivation, a record. We remain and keep a very open and frank dialogue with the government of Colombia to address the eradication of this very large feedstock for cocaine and to identify alternative cash crops to support rural Colombian farmers. In Central America, through the Alliance for Prosperity, we support countries as they address security and economic development in tandem. Last June in Miami, the State Department and the Department of Homeland Security, along with our Mexican counterparts, co-hosted the Conference on Prosperity and Security in Central America. Through many productive conversations with public and private sector leaders across the region, opportunities were identified to help Central American countries grow their economies, strengthen their institutions, and better protect their people. More opportunities for Central Americans will weaken the hold of transnational criminal organizations, address the underlying causes of legal and illegal immigration, and result in less violence. That makes their nation stronger, and it makes ours safer. And through the Caribbean Basin Security Initiative, partners along our third border, the Gulf of Mexico, are increasing their ability to perform maritime interdictions, rein in illegal firearms, counter corruption, and prosecute criminals. Over the summer, we submitted our Caribbean 2020 plans. This comprehensive strategy fosters closer security cooperation and reaffirms our commitment to encourage private sector growth and diversification of energy resources, creating energy security in the Caribbean. We also maintain our partnerships in education and health initiatives, including PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. The United States knows that our country and the rest of the region benefits from greater regional stability and the prospect of a growing economy throughout the hemisphere. The United States partnership with nations in the hemisphere is founded on shared values and democratic governance, but we cannot take it for granted. Many still live under the oppression of tyranny. The corrupt and hostile regime of Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela clings to a false dream and antiquated vision for the region that has already failed its citizens. It does not represent the vision of millions of Venezuelans or in any way comport with the norms of our Latin American, Canadian, or Caribbean partners. Our position has not changed. We urge Venezuela to return to its constitution, to return to free, open, and democratic elections, and to allow the people of Venezuela a voice in their government. We will continue to pressure the regime to return to the democratic process that made Venezuela a great country in the past. Venezuela stands in stark contrast to the future of stability pursued by so many others in the hemisphere. The great tragedy is that although Venezuela could be one of the most prosperous countries in the region, it is one of the poorest in the world. Venezuela GDP growth in 2004 was as high as 18%. 10 years later, it is nearly a negative 4%, all the result of man-made collapse. Venezuela boasts the world's largest proven oil reserves, but riches are reserved only for the ruling elites. As a consequence, the people suffer. Venezuelans are starving. Looting is common, and the sick do not receive the medical attention they desperately need. Venezuelans are dying of malnutrition and disease. There has been no natural disaster, nothing like that earthquake that took me to Peru. The Venezuelan people suffer because of a corrupt regime that steals from its own people. The Maduro regime is squarely to blame and must be held to account. The United States has imposed sanctions on more than 40 current or former Venezuelan government officials, individuals who support Maduro and his efforts to undermine democracy. Over the past year, we have worked with many of our Latin American partners through the Lima Group and the Organization of American States in particular to build support for coordinated action to counter the country's slide into dictatorship. We appreciate the Lima Group of major regional leaders who have met regularly to support the Venezuelan people's quest to regain their country. Canada, too, has sanctioned dozens of Venezuelan leaders, including Maduro himself. And recently, the European Union joined the growing global chorus to sanction leaders in the regime for human rights abuses. The world is waking to the plight of the Venezuelan people. We encourage all nations to support the Venezuelan people. The time has come to stand with freedom-loving nations, those that support the Venezuelan people, or choose to stand with Maduro dictatorship, if that is your choice. Elsewhere, we will continue to encourage others in the region, like Cuba, who disregard their people and ignore this democratic moment in Latin America, to give their people the freedom that they deserve. Cuba has an opportunity in their own transfer of power from decades of the Castro regime to take a new direction. In June, President Trump laid out a new vision for our approach to Cuba, one that supports the Cuban people by steering economic activity away from the military, intelligence, and security service, which disregard their freedom. The administration's policy, as written in the National Security Presidential Memorandum, also seeks to, quote, ensure that the engagement between the United States and Cuba advances the interest of the United States and that of the Cuban people. The Cuban people. It includes advancing human rights and encouraging the nascent private sector in Cuba. The future of our relationship is up to Cuba. The United States will continue to support the Cuban people in their struggle for freedom. Venezuela and Cuba remind us that for our hemisphere to grow and thrive, we must prioritize and promote democratic values. We must root out corruption in all of its forms. Ineffective corrupt governance damages countries. The economy suffers. People lose faith in institutions, and crime increases. Recent steps taken against corruption in Guatemala, Peru, the Dominican Republic, and Brazil underscore the importance of directly addressing it. In Guatemala, we continue to support the CICIG, a UN body created in 2006 to uphold the rule of law, strengthen accountability, and independently investigate illegal corrupt activity affecting government institutions. 2018 should be the year countries in the Western Hemisphere restore their trust with their people, the people they represent, and take serious anti-corruption action. Earlier, as I mentioned, the Summit of the Americas, hosted by Peru, will be hosted by Peru in April. We wholeheartedly support this year's theme, Democratic Governance Against Corruption, and we encourage every nation in the region to fully embrace it. Encouraging transparency, increasing accountability, rooting out corruption, all of these are essential to creating a sound economy for the region, promoting security, and protecting our values. Strong institutions and governments that are accountable to their people also secure their sovereignty against potential predatory actors that are now showing up in our hemisphere. China, as it does in emerging markets throughout the world, offers the appearance of an attractive path to development. But in reality, this often involves trading short-term gains for long-term dependency. Just think about the difference between the China model of economic development and the United States version. China's offer always comes at a price, usually in the form of state-led investments carried out by imported Chinese labor, onerous loans, and unsustainable debt. The China model extracts precious resources to feed its own economy, often with disregard for the laws of the land or human rights. Today, China is gaining a foothold in Latin America. It is using economic statecraft to pull the region into its orbit. The question is, at what price? China is now the largest trading partner of Chile, Argentina, Brazil, and Peru. While this trade has brought benefits, The unfair trading practices used by many Chinese have also harmed these countries' manufacturing sectors, generating unemployment and lowering wages for workers. Latin America does not need new imperial powers that seek only to benefit their own people. China's state-led model of development is reminiscent of the past. It doesn't have to be this hemisphere's future. Russia's growing presence in the region is alarming as well, as it continues to sell arms and military equipment to unfriendly regimes who do not share or respect democratic values. Our region must be diligent to guard against faraway powers who do not reflect the fundamental values shared in this region. The United States stands in vivid contrast. We do not seek short-term deals with lopsided returns. We seek partners with shared values and visions to create a safe, secure, and prosperous hemisphere. The U.S. approach is based on mutually beneficial goals to help both sides grow, develop, and become more prosperous, and do so by respecting international law, prioritizing the interests of our partners, and protecting our values. With the United States, you have a multidimensional partner, one that benefits both sides with engagement to support economic growth, education, innovation, and security. This year, the United States is eager to create even deeper relationships with Latin America and Caribbean partners, with the aim of expanding freedom to more people. We have a tremendous opportunity to build upon our shared history, culture, and values to generate more opportunity, more stability, more prosperity, and more resilient governance in South America, Central America, North America, and the Caribbean. In this year of the Americas, the United States will continue to be the Western Hemisphere's steadiest, strongest, and most enduring partner. Thank you for your kind attention.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
And welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The memo has come and gone, but this controversy is far from over. The political bias of the deep state has been revealed and illegal activities exposed. Who, if anyone, will be held responsible? Crosstalking the memo, I'm joined by my guest, Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. We also have Victor Olevich. He is a political analyst as well as a leading expert at the Center for Actual Politics. And we have Dmitry Babich. He is a political analyst with Sputnik International. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. We're going to talk about, this is kind of a post-mortem here. It might be a very long one, depending on how events unfold here. Let me just give real quickly for our viewers here six takeaways, most important takeaways from the memo that was recently released by the GOP regarding FISA warrant violations.
The House Intelligence Committee.
House Intelligence Committee. Hillary Clinton and the DNC hired a foreign spy to concoct a fake dossier on Trump. The Clinton campaign and the DNC gave fake dossier to Obama, DOJ, and FBI. The Department of Justice and FBI knew that the dossier was fake and politically motivated. The Department of Justice and the FBI present fake dossier to FISA court to get Trump wiretap. We're talking about Carter Page in this case. The DOJ and the FBI don't tell the FISA court that the dossier is fake and from Trump's political opponent, and the FISA court defrauded into ordering wiretapping of the Trump campaign. Again, Carter Page here. This is devastating, okay? Devastating. There is, well, six smoking guns at the very least. And from what I understand, this is, I hate using the term tip of the iceberg, but what the intelligence community made available through the White House was approximately 10%. There's a lot of underlying evidence that can be released that was based on these 6 points.
Look at the irony of the situation. The American intelligence community accused Russia of interfering in the election process in the United States. While in reality, there is not a single fact There is no base, there is no factual base for saying that at all. Russia did not interfere in American elections, but the American intelligence community
certainly
that made
did.
Those accusations
certainly
directly
did.
Interfered, illegally, unconstitutionally interfered in the American political process. And this memo outlines parts of that interference, not all of it. We know of other instances of how they interfered. And it shows what role the American intelligence community is playing in the American society, an unconstitutional role.
You know, Mark, what's really interesting to me when I read the four pages plus the 1.5 pages from the White House, I have to pat us all on the back. We basically got it all right.
Yeah,
we basically connected all of the dots.
That's what I wanted to say. Is actually there's very little new here.
Yeah.
Very little. We have been saying
it's all a confirmation.
Of this for a long time. It is a partial confirmation because, of course, the Democrats, the FBI, a whole host of former deep state officials from the liar, liar James Clapper on down came out and declared that releasing this was an attack on democracy,
attack
a
on security,
to our national security. The heavens would fall. Well, I think the U.S. is still there. Last time I checked, anyway, after the release of this
memo.
But,
you know, Dima, what the interesting thing was, and the flip side of what Mark is saying, is that, you know, it was a threat to national security. It's an affront to our intelligence agency, to law enforcement. You know, it used to be the liberals that used to be very, you know, worried about law enforcement. Everything is flipped over right now, okay?
Exactly.
But the interesting thing is, immediately after it was released, I don't know if anybody, these liberals or CNN or MSNBC actually read it, but then they just said, it's nothing to see here.
Yes.
Move along. How could they, within one news cycle, it was a threat to national security, then move
that's,
along,
that's
nothing to see here.
Well, I think what we should prevent from happening here is this let's move on attitude prevailing again. Because we understand where it comes from. Trump is basically leading the same policies now as Hillary Clinton and Obama had been leading before Trump was elected, right? He struck at Syria. He published this awful nuclear posture review, right? So he is basically moving the country towards war, moving humanity towards destruction. So now they are prepared to let it be, you know.
Well, I think they're prepared to let it be for very different reasons here. Victor, I mean, you have... You know, the former director of the FBI, I mean, I watched the hearings. He perjured himself repeatedly. And I'm sorry, let's make sure. You know, I wonder, Mike Flynn, was he watching? Or did he read the memo? Did Paul Manafort read the memo too? They're indicted, okay? But we have a whole cast of characters at the DOJ and the FBI that perjured themselves in front of committees under... Oath.
What is outrageous?
Dima, you can't walk away from that.
James Clapper did. Obama's director of national intelligence did it twice under oath.
Okay, and maybe he did it
on
other occasions.
What is really outrageous here is James Comey going to Twitter and proclaiming himself a victim, alike to the victims of Joe McCarthy. Comey, Mueller, Rosenstein, these are the loving descendants
of
Joe
McCarthy.
Can I put the cherry on top, okay, gentlemen? Okay. Headline from the New York Times, the failing New York Times. Trump's unparalleled war on a pillar of society. Law enforcement. I mean, this is Orwellian. I mean, from what I read from those four pages, that the deep state is at war with a democratically elected government or president of the United States. That is the assault that's going
Absolutely.
On right now. This is so duplicitous. It is so hypocritical. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, one of the biggest accusations is it's starting to undermine Americans' trust in their intelligence community. I don't know.
Secret. I mean,
I can't speak for all of you out there, but I've been doubting our intelligence community since, the Iraq War, since the Gulf of Tonkin.
From
the Libyan genocide. To the Spanish-American War and detonating ships.
In fact, if I could for a minute, about the Foreign Intelligence Court that this memo deals with. The whole reason for setting up FISA, the court, was to prevent the abuses that the American intelligence community did in the 70s, in the 60s, in the 50s. So post-Watergate America decided to create this act. And what do we see now? We see that, first of all, let's go back to how this court functions. If we look at its record of this court, the vast majority, almost every single
episode. I think it's 99.3%.
Yes, exactly. 99.8%. Okay. This is a secret court that hears secret arguments about how our intelligence community wants to spy on American citizens. They approve 99.8% of cases brought against it. No credible oversight or check on authority. It's a rubber stamp secret court, and they're spying on American citizens. And this is they bring obviously fraudulent evidence in front of it.
But you're right. But I mean, let's finish it. The thread here: spying on American citizens. A citizen who is working for a presidential candidate. Yeah. I mean, this was the whole reason that the FISA courts were put up, to make sure something like this would happen. And actually, because of the way it was set up, we have Comey and we have the rest of them. They know how to go around it.
Let's be perfectly clear about this. No one of these people seriously believed that Carter Page or George Papadopoulos, these bumbling intern idiots, were Russian agents. This was an attempt to use their bumbling to get intelligence wiretaps inside the Trump campaign.
It's true. Well, what I find especially astonishing about this whole story is that FISA warrant was based on a story written by Michael Isikoff on Yahoo.
Yeah. And Michael Isikoff, where did he get the story from?
Took his facts from Christopher Steele. The story is that DNC campaign pays Christopher Steele so that he would dig dirt on Trump, like him going to Moscow hotels, meeting with prostitutes there, sleeping on Obama's former bed, you know, in a hotel. Then Michael Isikoff takes an interview from this guy, and then FISA decides, the whole puzzle fits together. There is a conspiracy against the United States.
But we do also know that the FISA court was not made aware of the origins and the author of this dossier, okay? They also were not told this article that was in Yahoo News was also connected to Christopher Steele.
I could correct them very easily. You know, let the FISA court just read Michael Isikoff's stories about Russia.
I think we should say
that the evidence was so shabby that even this rubber stamp court
had to be lied to get
the warrant. It's that bad. It's that bad.
We should stress this again. This was the evidence put forward to wiretap an American citizen who was working for Trump's campaign or had recently stopped working in the case of Carter Page, that when it was renewed, that they not only used this dodgy opposition research tabloid scandal news from a foreign spook that the U.S. intelligence community itself says has minimal corroborability, meaning it's complete horse fodder. But to back it up, they used a Yahoo news story that is talking to the same people, references the same document. I mean, the biggest shock to most of us might be that Yahoo is still out there.
Michael Isikoff has a book coming on this very subject.
Next month, I wonder
if he's going to have to do some rewording editing.
He wrote a number of books on Russia, on the Middle East. You know, just read his stories on Russia and the Middle East. He's an extremely unobjective journalist. But I just loved what Feist actually believed. So, FISA warrant mentioned information on George Papadopoulos. Which one? Papadopoulos told an Australian diplomat in a London bar that a Maltese professor connected to Russia had told him he had dirt on Clinton. Well, even Stalin's secret police would not accept it. You know, like, you talk to someone in a London bar who was from Malta and who reportedly had connections to Russia.
It sounds like a really bad script, Hollywood script here. Gentlemen, we're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on the memo. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
All right, gentlemen, let's continue with the memo, but I'm going to change a different path here. Watching MSNBC, CNN, they're absolutely giving complete cover. I saw one segment with Wolf Blitzer talking, I think it was to a congressman, and he kept talking about his issue was, well, why didn't you release at the same time? Because the Democrats are going to have one. And finally, the congressman was quite polite. He said, well, can we talk about the contents of the memo instead of the timing of a memo we don't know much about because it hasn't been completely written, okay? This is the tactic. Again, nothing to see, move along. But they're giving cover to it. Like I gave the New York Times title right here, they don't want to talk about it. A lot of people are talking about it, and it has amazing implications here.
The real potential criminality, and there is actual, not just misuse of authority here, questions, but there is a potential criminality in if there was false presentation of evidence to the FISA, the secret court, when the FBI investigation was requesting wiretaps on Carter Page. That's the potential for criminality. But it has to be said, of course, the Democrats, the neocons, are completely denying. They say that things are being taken out of context. Now, they put forward kind of a rebuttal memo headed by Adam Schiff. That's been blocked by the Trump administration. That should not be blocked. Let's have all of this out in the open.
No, because it isn't just like the GOP memo. It was scoured and it was checked. Okay, the Democrats haven't done their homework yet.
It should be made public. As
I think it should be.
All of the underlying evidence, which is clearly not any threat to national security, right? As it indicated in this memo, all the underlying evidence should be unclassified and made public. And this is where the hypocrisy of the Republicans comes in, because they just 2 weeks ago renewed the same FISA powers that they claim have been abused
here. You know,
Democrats, Republicans together.
And there was no discussion. There was no debate about it.
They handed these powers to Trump, that the Democrats say, you know, is a tyrant, a despot, so on. The Republicans, meanwhile, are talking about the deep state, which, you know, of course, is also a threat, but they don't have a problem renewing the powers either. So there's a bit of hypocrisy on both sides here. All the evidence needs to be made available to the public
see
this.
You know, Victor, what about the Mueller investigation? I mean, if this is, you know, 10% of the underlying, and this is according to the GOP, let's be fair, what does the Russia investigation have two legs to stand on right now?
Look, the, Robert Mueller and those who put him in that place where he is right now are dead set on removing the elected president of the United States. And they're going to try to do their best to go through this and to reach their goal despite all the obstacles that are put in their path.
They're going to need a paddy wagon to pick up a lot of people. And from the fourth floor of the FBI? I mean, there's a lot of people involved right now. One of the reasons I'm asking this is that given the media cover that the deep state is being given here, I mean, this is a growing confrontation. We have documentation, people under oaths in front of Congress during interviews have lied. Okay? And it can't stop right there. Rosenstein is still sitting in his office right now.
Yes, in fact,
one has to wonder what he's doing.
You know, in the entire history of the FBI, not a single director of that agency, not a single director of the CIA, of the NSA, ever went to prison. And it's not because they never abused power. It's not because they never committed crimes, according to the American Constitution, the American Criminal Code. But it's because the power they exercise in the American society, in the American political order, is so overwhelming that they are essentially above the law.
But it's been revealed this time, okay? We've seen behind the curtain here. You know, Dima, this is a growing crisis here because, there's enough evidence here to put a lot of doubt. Yes. And let's be clear here. I don't want to repeat the same mantra that I keep hearing, but the good people at the FBI. I am not going to say that because I don't know, okay?
Straight shooters. They're all straight shooters.
Well,
do you notice that?
Yeah. But the interesting thing here, this is really, again, when we started out, Mark, at the end of the Obama administration, changing all of those regulations about having access to classified information, unmasking and whatnot. I mean, this is falling solely on the administration that just left office. Okay, the Absolutely. Obama administration, True. All of these people that we're talking about are his appointees. Okay, this is coming to a head right here. What? I mean, I may differ with Victor here. I think this is an opportunity for Trump. Not that I necessarily like him very much, mm-hmm. but this would be an opportunity for him to clean house, and he may have justification
for these reasons. And that's what they're afraid of. I mean, look what...
Of course they're terrified of it.
Look what the Washington Post writes about it. They're not afraid that people were actually lying under oath. They're afraid that President Trump may lash out with Nixonian ferocity at the Justice Department and the FBI. Well, Nixon was rationing out.
Yeah, and make it very clear here. You know, something. You know, all the media does is it casts this unbelievable shadow around the president of the United States. The president of the United States can fire anybody he wants in the executive branch, and he doesn't need a reason. He can do it.
Yes, for more than a year, the media has been trying to delegitimize Trump and his administration. They have been doing it every day, every hour, and every minute of their coverage. And they're going to continue doing it until they believe that they have reached their goal. But, of course, even Nancy Pelosi in the last few days admitted that a constitutional crisis is possible in the very near future in the United States because of the situation developing now. Because you said correctly, it's a train wreck coming.
You know,
constitutional crisis.
What was it? Who was it who said it? Was it Clapper? You know, there's six ways to Sunday to get you, okay? Yeah. I mean, that's a threat here. And so we have... And the DOJ and the FBI absolutely have resources to defend themselves, but you know they're defending themselves against the Constitution. This is the crisis that I'm talking about.
Well, of course, they see themselves as performing a noble act,
of course.
Right? I mean, that's
Peter struck all those messages to his girlfriend. Right. Yes, very noble people.
Right. So the FBI, whose officials perjured themselves to the FISA court in order to get
a warrant,
the warrant approved, then are charging. Carter Page Papadopoulos with lying about things that actually weren't criminal to begin with. But I think there's two details in these documents that really struck out at me. They're not pivotal towards criminality, but they speak to a wider conspiracy. One is Bruce Orr's wife. He is the deputy attorney general.
Similar with McCabe.
She works for Fusion GPS. Yes. And she worked specifically on getting this dodgy dossier, this tabloid sheet, presented to the FBI. And she continued contacts even after all of this nonsense was over with. Similarly, Andrew McCabe, whose name is signatory on all these FISA documents, he is the former FBI assistant director who just resigned when all of this came out in the last couple of weeks. His wife ran for office, Virginia State Senate, as a Democrat, getting $700,000 from Clinton allies. This is all, of course, such ridiculous conflicts of interest.
Nothing to see there.
Right? Nothing to see there.
But I like the comment.
It does speak to a wider, conspiracy.
Yeah. I like the comment from the New York Times about all of this. The Republicans' assertion that investigators might have lied about Mr. Steele is potentially problematic. But this is nothing compared to a constitutional crisis that may be unleashed by the White House if it decides to fire Mueller or, as now seems likely, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein.
Yeah, but General Flynn, speaking to the FBI without a lawyer, it wasn't recorded. It is what the memory of the interrogators. The New York Times would never call that problematic.
He was a traitor anyway, so he would have to be caught,
It was similar to as if you were, for example, accused of grand larceny, you were dragged into an interrogation, and the investigator would find out you had nothing to do with that. But in the course of your interview, you would say that, let's say, last Thursday you went to the supermarket to buy milk, and they checked your check from the supermarket and said you bought orange juice, so you lied under oath.
Yes.
And
grand jury, now!
Exactly. Well, I mean, I also like the accusation against this Nunes report that they cherry-pick facts, right? The fact that Obama, in May 2016, promised G7 leaders that Trump would not become become the president of the United States, this elephant in the room is never mentioned, right? The fact that 95% of the mainstream media supported Hillary Clinton is never mentioned.
One of the things, Dima, that we need to find out in the rest of the 90% here is the importance of these FISA warrants are of such a level of importance that one has to assume that the President of the United States was aware during his briefings in the morning. I think we're going to find that out if he was aware of this here on the back end of what you were just saying there. Go ahead, Mark.
My prize of the week goes to John McCain. John McCain, out of the most desperate of all the desperate attempts to try to wash over this, to try to discredit the memo, he said there's only one person that benefits from this memo.
And we can say it in unison. Vladimir Putin.
Yeah, you win the Neil McCarthyite prize of the week.
Those Patrick are probably going to be the last words John McCain goes away from us.
Patrick Buchanan, speaking in The American Conservative, I think summed the whole thing up very well. This is from The American Conservative, former U.S. presidential candidate Patrick Buchanan. Trump haters in the press may be terrified that the memo may credibly demonstrate that the deplorables were right, that the elite media have been had, that they were exploited and used by the deep state, that they let their detestation of Trump so blind them to reality that they made fools of themselves, and they credited with high nobility a major conspiracy to overthrow an elected president of the United States.
And despite all that came out in the last few days, the deep state and Robert Mueller and others, they will not stop. They will attempt to go on. They will try to go on and accomplish their goal of removing an elected American president.
Well, it's not going to be pretty. It's going to be...
Even if we don't like it.
This is a dangerous time to be living in.
I view this situation like from a bird's eye, right? I think that the deep state and in general, you know, this ultra-liberal ideology, which is ruling the United States, if Trump approves the nuclear posture, if he moves towards a nuclear war, if he is...
Okay, Dima, I'm going to jump in here. Gentlemen, we've run out of time for this. Many thanks to my guests here in Moscow, and thanks to our viewers for watching us here, RT. This is the end of our broadcast segment. Stay with us for the extended version on our YouTube channel. See you next time, and remember, Vostok rules.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.